Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And happy to welcome Dan Cohen to the show. He is a regular writer for MondoWeiss.net, our friend Phil Weiss, and is an independent journalist based in Palestine. You can follow him on Twitter at DanCohen3000. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me. I'm good. I'm in the old city of Jerusalem right now, and just saw an animal sacrifice. So interesting stuff.
Yeah, the very old city, I guess. All right.
Exactly.
All right. So, you know what? One thing I left out of your bio introduction there is that you're making a movie with Max Blumenthal, I think, about the Gaza War of 2014. Is that right? Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, indeed. My co-producer Max Blumenthal and I are in the kind of later stages of making a film about the 2014 assault on Gaza, which killed more than 2,200 people, including 550 children. And we've titled it Killing Gaza, for obvious reasons. And basically, I spent 5 months in the Gaza Strip, including the last 3 weeks of the war, filming on the ground and kind of just showing what it's like for the survivors in Gaza, not only during the war, but after the journalists left, after the cameras went away, for people who are kind of eking out their life in neighborhoods that have been completely wiped out. So we have an Indiegogo campaign going right now that we have about 10 days left. We're trying to reach our goal so we can get everyone involved in the project paid properly and finish it and hopefully have it out later this spring.
Great. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, too. I was going to ask you. I thought I had seen that you guys have a fundraiser going on. So that's Killing Gaza at Indiegogo. And Dan, we're having a problem with your microphone there. It sounds like wind, but possibly it's a shirt rustling, something like that.
How's that?
Yes, that's much better.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Okay, good deal. And yes, that's Killing Gaza, and you say you expect it this spring and raising money at Indiegogo. So I'm glad we got a chance to talk about that for a minute there. Okay,
yeah,
so,
you can email us at killinggaza@gmail.com or go to killinggaza.com or just, you know, hit me on Twitter and I can get back to you. But yeah.
Great. All right, good deal. I hope you guys will participate in helping them get this thing done. And, you know, this audience is pretty primed for that kind of work, for sure. I know I want to see it.
Right on.
All right, now listen, you got this very important piece here. New discriminatory legislation being considered by the Knesset narrows the meaning of democracy in Israel. And there's a little bit more of that wind there, so if you know how to fix that.
Okay, let me see what I can do here.
Sure. And then and then please explain, what is this new legislation and how likely is it to be passed?
Well, some of it already has passed. So this is a report that Adala put out on March 1st. Adala is an NGO in Israel that kind of monitors rights abuses for the Arab minority. And so there's nothing in the report that sets a huge precedent. It's basically the continuing, you know, falling away of the facades of democracy in Israel, not only in Israel, but in the occupied West Bank and occupied East Jerusalem as well. And so these range from they have changed the basically broadened the definition of stone throwing, for instance. So, you know, a basic form of resistance, throwing stones at anyone invading your village, now has been changed to you can be arrested and imprisoned without even they don't have to prove that you were intending to cause harm. So hypothetically, if you were skipping a stone on a lake, then that is a punishable offense. And for adults, you can and actually even children, you can be put in jail for up to 20 years. And for adults, there are mandatory minimums of 2 years for throwing a stone. There's a bill being discussed right now that would ban anyone supporting the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. So this is very anti-democratic. It's simple expression. And that includes Jews who support BDS. So if you're a Jew who is, you know, against occupation and you support the BDS movement, you can actually be banned from entering Israeli-controlled borders. The list goes on, but basically it's just continuing this, I would even, go stronger than narrowing of democracy. It's just the continuing, shedding the facade, really. And we're seeing just this, like, brutal apartheid state, apartheid regime, coming out and, as it shifts rightward.
Mm-hmm. And now, can you explain a little bit more? And I'm sorry, I was actually changing which ear had a headphone on it. I think right at the moment that you were saying about whether it had passed or not, the one about kicking the or did you mention? I'm sorry, the one about kicking the where the Knesset gets to vote to kick out any minor party that they don't want to be there anymore.
Right.
You know, I had read a Jonathan Cook piece about this that he made it sound like very soon they could kick all the last Arabs out of the Knesset entirely.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I did not mention that, but this is another one of them that, just kind of shows what Israeli democracy really means. So there's no...
I mean, it's already... The society's already engineered to be 80-20. We're talking within 67 borders, the people with the right to vote.
Right.
It's already
right.
designed to be 80-20 super-duper majority, so there's basically no point in even having a party anyway, but still, right?
Right. I mean, and you'll hear, like, pro-Israel propagandists brag that there are Arabs in the Knesset. They even have the right to vote, but, and they're represented. But this came about, actually, after... A couple of Arab members of Knesset visited an accused attacker, a Palestinian attacker. And so they said, oh, they're giving, the Knesset members and public erupted saying they're giving support to terrorists. Meanwhile, you have Ayelet Shaked, the justice minister that, was one of the highest officials in the land who visited the family of one of the killers, the alleged killers, in the Duma firebombing last year when a few settlers went into a Palestinian village in the middle of the night and threw firebombs on a sleeping family and burned an 18-month-old baby and the parents to death. So it's okay for the justice minister to go and visit the family of this person, but it's not okay for a Palestinian, member of Knesset to do the, inverse, if we could even call it that. And so it's purely,
Yeah, and you can't call it that because it's, maybe it's the inverse or some kind of word. It isn't the opposite because again, the equivalence between the victim and the perpetrator here is
right.
not equivalent. And I mean, imagine
right.
that everybody, if, the Attorney General of the United States had gone to visit the family of Dylann Roof, who did the Charleston massacre in the basement of the black church. And went
exactly.
to the Attorney General of the United States. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, the Justice Minister of Israel, going to visit the families of the perpetrators of a massacre of innocent civilians by fire in their own home in the middle of the night.
Right, exactly.
Unbelievable. I mean, can you imagine if this was going on in Iran or in Russia or in some state that Hillary Clinton had singled out to be destroyed or contained?
Yeah, it would be outrage. It would be cause for war. Absolutely.
It's really, I mean, it's almost, I don't know. It's unbelievable and yet shocking, but not surprising. That's the refrain around here. Shocking, but not surprising.
And, I mean, and it's, as if Ayelet Shaked was even ever like a moderate figure to begin with, before she was appointed, or maybe it was after she was appointed justice minister. No, I'm sorry. It was before. It was in 2014 during the war on Gaza. Mm-hmm. She posted a link on her Facebook or a quote on her Facebook calling to genocide Palestinians, including the mothers, because they give birth to little snakes.
Hold it right there. So, we'll be right back with Dan Cohen right after this, guys. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Dan Cohen. He's a regular writer at MondoWeiss.net, independent journalist. He's working on a new movie with Max Blumenthal right now called Killing Gaza, about the slaughter. You can't really call it a war. A war is when two armies are fighting. I learned that from Bill Hicks. The one-sided slaughter in Gaza in 2014. And also, he's written some important stuff here. And we're talking about all this new legislation coming through the Knesset here to just further... That's their Congress over there, their parliament over there in Israel. To further marginalize, dehumanize, and deprive rights and representation from the Palestinians, their subjects. And this is, I think, it's mostly pertaining to Palestinian citizens of Israel rather than just the people in the occupied territories. I mean, we're talking about even stripping the last of their representation in the Knesset out. But I wanted to go back to, Dan, the thing that you mentioned about the changing of the law regarding the throwing of stones, and what exactly that means, in what context, when who does what did it used to be, what is it now, as best you can for us, please.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, stone throwing is, of course, the like most basic form of resistance.
Right. Because there's gun control in Palestine. It works real well for the Israelis.
Right. Exactly. It works in their favor. Absolutely. So yeah, it's the most basic form of resistance. And, you know, any time that, the Israeli military or, like border police, which is actually a paramilitary unit, will invade, a Palestinian village or neighborhood, you can expect that there will be stone throwing. And if you ask, you know, young Palestinian guys or even boys, really, who are out there throwing stones, why they're doing it, it's not that they think that it's actually going to repel the soldiers, but to show, you know, is like a kind of to assert their dignity and that that soldiers are not welcome. You also see stone throwing from the ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel against police when they have demonstrations. But they are not met with any force. It kind of shows the apartheid situation we're in here.
Yeah, exactly. The stone throwers who always go ignored, those who throw stones at little Palestinian children trying to get to school in the morning.
Right. Or, yeah, I mean, that's what we see with settlers all the time. It's really frequent when you see settlers throwing stones, and, you know, that's about the nicest thing they'll do to Palestinians. But then you'll see, soldiers standing by, or even sometimes joining in. It's all, you know, it's basically a pretext, like you said, to you know, mete out collective punishment and erode rights. The new law basically it broadens the definition of stone throwing. So now you can be arrested for stone throwing, even if they don't have to you can be arrested for stone throwing and they don't have to prove that there is intent to cause harm. So if you're skipping rocks on a lake, that is a punishable offense where you can be put into prison for up to 20 years. There are mandatory minimums of 2 years. The mandatory minimums don't exist for minors. They could put an 8-year-old child in prison for 20 years for throwing a rock. a Palestinian child.
And now, so let me make sure I understand you here. I think what you're implying, at least, is that there used to be a defense that we're talking about an 8-year-old boy throwing a tiny little rock that couldn't possibly be more than symbolic. If you hit the IDF soldier right in the face, it's not even going to break his nose. So therefore, Your Honor, this is, you know, there was no intent to cause harm here, but you're saying now that defense will be stripped away?
I mean, I can't say that, like, you know, throwing a rock can never cause harm. I mean, you could bash a windshield, and it's not like it's just a tiny pebble. I mean,
but I'm just talking about the argument that would have been used before, that this...
Right.
Or, I mean, is that right? I mean, it sounds like you're sort of implying that that was a defense that used to be usable and now is will no longer be.
I mean, I don't even know if it was ever used... in practice, if it was ever usable, you know, it just creates more and more pretext.
I see. They're just making sure that nobody's ever going to get away with this. And you're saying that, and you're saying that the sentences could apply even to the children.
They do apply to the children. The only difference is that there's no mandatory minimums for children.
Right. But the maximum is still allowed for them.
20
years. If the judge wants to.
Yep. 20 years in prison. Yep.
Unbelievable. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, you have this, this other entry here, Dan, at MondoWeiss.net.
Mm-hmm.
Meet
mm-hmm.
Ahmad Dawabshi, the 5-year-old survivor of the Douma firebombing that you had previously mentioned there. You tell us, first of all, explain again what it was that happened there, and then tell us about meeting this child.
Sure. So, last summer, July 31st, a couple, well, we don't know exactly how many, at least two, settlers, Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank, went to a small village called Douma in the middle of the night. And they had planned an operation, an attack, and they went and carried it out, and they went and found a house where there were, where the family was sleeping, and they threw a Molotov cocktail in the house. An 18-month-old baby named Ali burned to death immediately. The mother and father, Riham and Saad, burned to death weeks later. They died of their injuries. And the only survivor was a 4-year-old boy named Ahmed. And so Ahmed has second-degree burns, and he's continuing to recover in a hospital in Israel. Israel initially said that this is terrorism, and under Israeli law, victims of so-called terror are eligible for compensation, and the Israeli government will pay for it. But because Ahmed is Palestinian and the attack was carried out by Jews, he is not eligible. And so the Israeli government refused to compensate the family for this, and so the Palestinian Authority ended up paying for his treatment. And so Ahmed has been in a hospital in Israel for, I mean, we're going on 8 months now. His grandfather takes care of him, which, you know, I guess he's really fortunate to have that. If we can say this poor little boy is fortunate at all. And so I was able to spend a day, a few hours with Ahmed and his grandfather. And I released a video, the day before yesterday, about the family, just showing the relationship between Ahmed and his grandfather. And as a little boy, he is fearful that everyone he loves is going to be burned to death. He didn't want his grandfather to go to the trial, which is just starting, because he thought, the people at the trial would burn his grandfather to death. And so he doesn't really understand, that his parents and his baby brother are gone and are never coming back. He thinks they're in heaven, but that's just like a place he can go visit. This is just this brutal, brutal reality that's, you know, conveniently kind of hidden from a lot of media that we consume.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting too here where, you know, at the end, you talk about the settlers chanting Douma number 2 in a mocking way, threatening to murder more kids with fire, basically.
Right, right. I mean, you have really ideologically extreme people out there, and the vast majority can take their violent impulses that they've been indoctrinated into and put those into the military, where instead of going and throwing a firebomb in like a vigilante way into a house, you can be an Air Force pilot and get in an airplane and a warplane and drop a bomb on Gaza on a sleeping family on Gaza, which I witnessed in October, so where this house was completely wiped out, and it was a similar result, an entire family dead. Actually, I should say the mother and the little girl were dead. The father and the brother survived. And that didn't cause any outrage. Nobody had a problem with that because it was in the confines of the state. It's absolutely horrifying stuff. It's just, the fact that there was so much, commotion and kind of outrage over this specific killing after the summer before Israel had killed 550 children. Says everything about state versus vigilante to me.
Yeah. Hey, let me ask you, you spent so much time over there, or I don't know how much time you spend in Israel as compared to among the Palestinians, but do you hear just much open kind of racism? Oh, they're all whatever, camel jockeys or sand N-words or whatever, this kind of calling them gooks of one kind or another in order to dehumanize them, or how does that work that I'm always interested in the rationalizations of these kinds of things, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I can say with confidence that, and sadly, Israeli society is the most racist society I've ever seen. It's not uncommon in conversation to hear calls for genocide, extremely violent, calls. In contrast, I don't really see that with Palestinians. They'll say, you often hear the Jews this, the Jews that, but that's simply obliging what, Zionists want to be called. If Zionists say we are the Jewish state, then Palestinians calling them the Jews are just obliging them. There's serious indoctrination going on that's not really a secret in Israeli society. It's just not covered in the U.S. An Israeli author named Nurit, I have to think of her name, Nurit Elhanan, I think, who wrote, Peled Elhanan, that's it, who wrote a book deconstructing, Israeli, education system and showing, where the racism comes from. I interviewed, the Haaretz education correspondent, and he talked about the violence in the streets, beating up protesters in the streets. This all goes down to the education system starting from the earliest age. Another important thing to discuss is the way the Holocaust is taught in Israeli society, where basically a lot of Israeli Jews are taught that they're surrounded by Nazis, or, that Palestinians are the modern incarnation of Nazis who want to genocide them. And the only thing that you can do to prevent that is to join the Israeli army and be a good soldier.
Yeah, that was exactly what my next question was going to be, was, right along those lines of that. There's the great documentary I'm sure you've seen called Defamation, which
yes.
is an Israeli Jew who went out in search of anti-Semitism and couldn't find very much anyway. But the way he portrays at the beginning, the way he portrays Israeli society, it's like America in 2002, right? Or America during the Red Scare, right? During McCarthy, right? 2002 on steroids, kind of level of paranoia and irrational fear of the other. And that was what I was going to ask you was, would you make that comparison? It really is that like unhinged fear from this country, which actually faces no threats from any of its neighbors at all?
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair depiction. I wouldn't say it faces no threats, but the threats that it does face for sure are absolutely overstated and overblown to the Israeli public even in order to keep them in a state of fear. But certainly, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon poses a significant, threat to Israel. But Israel doesn't do anything to find, some kind of resolution to that. It's always looking for another war. The Israeli government always is looking for another war.
And that's a good point that Hezbollah is still independent and under control up there, but Assad never threatened, Israel.
Yeah,
Jordan doesn't threaten Israel. Egypt doesn't threaten Israel. The Mediterranean Sea don't threaten Israel. And we're out of neighbors now. So.
Yeah. By and large. Egypt, the Sisi regime is absolutely, pro-Israel and is so zealous in its support, for, smothering Gaza that, you know, it even surprises Israeli leaders sometimes. Jordan is basically a human warehouse where it's mostly Palestinians. It's a human warehouse for, Israel. And then, yeah, so Assad is true. It never really posed any threat.
Anyway, but yeah, the point being the level of paranoia in contrast to the level of danger is the real thing.
Right, right. I mean, it's basically a hypersensitive and hyper-violent society is how I would characterize it. So, you know, I mean, even if we look at like, what's the threat from Gaza? How many Israelis have actually died from rockets from Gaza? It's 44 since 2000, 2001, you know, many of which are soldiers.
Right. And I mean, again, just like he said about Hezbollah, that's just assuming that there's nothing that can be done about it, in terms of peaceful negotiation or change or whatever like that. So,
right. Yeah.
All right. So now listen, I'm sorry, man. I kept you way over time, and I really got to go, Dan, but I really appreciate you coming on today. It's been great.
Absolutely.
And I really enjoy reading you too. Oh,
right,
I'm sorry. And
lot,
tell them real quick again about the movie and how they can help support.
Yeah, check out killinggaza.com. Message me on Twitter at DanCohen3000. We have our Kickstarter going, Indiegogo going on right now. So if you can help out, we really appreciate it. But yeah, otherwise, just look for the movie Killing Gaza later this spring, and yeah, we'll make it happen.
All right, good deal. Thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks a lot, Scott.
All right, y'all. We'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all. Scott here. The Ciceronian Society is an interdisciplinary group devoted to the timeless themes of place, tradition, and things divine. You are invited to their 6th annual conference to hear 2 days of papers on important thinkers, from Plato and St. Benedict to John Locke, Hayek, and Henry David Thoreau. The conference is March 10th through 12th in historic Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, less than 2 hours from D.C. and Baltimore. Register at CiceronianSociety.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com.